The Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. As everyone is aware, we are doing a Zoom argument today. This will be available for public viewing, I think, tomorrow. But obviously, our own rules prohibit anyone from making a private recording, so please respect that. Our first case this morning is 822-1475, the State of Minnesota versus Tracy Mitchell. Appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So counsel for the the appellant, whenever you're ready, just please begin by telling us who you are in a loud voice, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Donovan. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant in this case, Tracy Mitchell. Minnesota law prohibits people convicted of certain felonies from possessing firearms. While the statute as written does not contain a mens rea element, courts have read one into the statute. The person must knowingly possess the firearm. But that single mens rea element is not enough.
Just a minute, Mr. Donovan, because now I'm already off track and you're just starting. Courts have read a mens rea element into the offense? Are you talking about Minnesota courts? And if so, what's the authority you're relying on?
Minnesota courts have. I know there's a recent Supreme Court decision where the possession must be knowing. That was State v. Harris. I believe I mentioned it in my brief, and that the felon in possession statute requires knowing possession of the firearm. Our argument today, though, is that that single mens rea element is not enough. Mens rea is the element that requires the defendant to know the facts that make their conduct illegal, and it separates those who understand the wrongful nature of their act from those who do not. Here, it is not the person's possession of a firearm that makes the conduct illegal. As this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have noted, this country has a long tradition of legal gun ownership, and it's usually licit and blameless behavior. But for Mr. Mitchell's 27-year-old out-of-state conviction, his conduct was legal. It was his status, and not his possession alone, that makes the difference between legal and illegal firearm possession. We therefore are asking this court to hold that the ineligible person in possession of a firearm statute requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt or an admission by a defendant that they knew they were ineligible to possess a firearm. Because Mr. Mitchell did not admit that he knew that his 27-year-old Colorado conviction rendered him ineligible, we ask that he be permitted to withdraw his guilty plea.
But Mr. Donovan, you're not claiming that your client didn't know he was a felon.
Correct. We're not making that claim. I think that's a difference between the federal law and the Greer case that the state cited and the Minnesota law. Is under federal law, anyone convicted of any felony is ineligible. Under Minnesota law, though, it's only certain felonies that prohibit firearm possession.
Well, where in the statute is there a requirement that at the time of the offense, that the defendant must know that his status as a felon prohibits him from carrying a gun?
That requirement is not contained within the statute. As I noted, as written...
How do you address then, if it's not contained in the statute, how do you address the State v. Winthy case where the court held that when the state does not provide a mens rea requirement, the court will not supply one?
On a couple of grounds. One, courts typically, very routinely, provide for that mens rea requirement. The other piece is that in Wenthe, the court said it wasn't going to add a second mens rea element because there was already a mens rea element. The Wenthe court cited for, I think it's Bookwalter, for the sexual penetration in that case must be intentional. So that already had a mens rea element. They weren't going to read a second mens rea element into that statute.
All right. On the mens rea element, I'm reviewing Harris, which you're relying on, and that's a circumstantial evidence case where the Supreme Court said to be convicted of a firearm by an ineligible person, the state was to show that he knowingly possessed the firearm. That's not the case here. The case here is whether he, you're talking about his Colorado conviction and that element. So I don't know where you get the mens rea application in Harris. Can you explain that?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think that the parties are necessarily contending. If we are, I'll let the state address that. But there is already a mens rea element in the statute. As you just said, it must be knowing possession. That's the mens rea that's currently in the statute. What we are asking today, which a court in Minnesota has not held, is for this court to read a second mens rea element into the statute.
I'm getting at, is there any authority for that, that the second requirement? I mean, you're asking us to do something as contrary to statute, and I don't know how we can do that. I mean, if we wanted to, how can we do that?
It's not contrary to statute. Just because the statute doesn't have a mens rea element doesn't mean the courts won't read a mens rea element into it. I think the strong case, the court says, we very typically will read mens rea into it. In Rehaf, which is a United States Supreme Court, talks a lot about the basics of mens rea. The basic principle of mens rea is you need to know the facts that make your conduct illegal. So the reason that we're asking to read a second mens rea element into this statute is because Mr. Mitchell's possession of a firearm, anyone's possession of a firearm, is not per se illegal. The possession is not what makes it illegal. What makes it illegal is that he has that prior conviction for a crime of violence that in the state of Minnesota makes it illegal. So we are asking this court to read in a mens rea element that says you have to know that you are ineligible in order for a conviction under the statute.
Mr. Donovan, is there any, I mean, I think it took me a while, but I think I understand the argument. I guess my first question is, do you know, is there any state in the union where you can be a felon and still possess a firearm? Do you know that?
In Minnesota, you could still be a felon and possess a firearm because it's only certain felonies that prohibit you from possessing a firearm.
Is there any evidence in the record that, he didn't know because no one in Colorado told him that he couldn't possess a firearm? Or is there evidence in the record that he forgot that that he couldn't possess one because no one told him? Is there anything like that in the record?
There's not anything like that. And I admit that that would be tough because of how old it is.
Right.
But it's not just that he's a felon. It's that he knew that his Colorado conviction was considered a crime of violence, therefore prohibiting him in Minnesota. I think that's the catch here, is that it's not that all felons can't possess it. It's that certain felons can. And
how does your argument square with the principle that ignorance of the law is no defense? I mean, he knew he was a felon. You admitted that. I don't think anyone is claiming here that he didn't know he was a felon. I mean, doesn't he have some responsibility to know what the laws are in light of his felony status?
Two pieces to that. First is that it's not just that he's a felon, that he is a crime of violence in Minnesota. And secondly, I think that the Rehaf case, the Supreme Court case that I talk about a lot, that addresses this squarely, because that was an argument made in that case. And what the court said is, this is sort of tricky, and people have failed to distinguish between different scenarios and apply ignorance of the law a lot. But what it is that if you do the act with that requisite mental state, that's when ignorance of the law, that maxim would apply, and you can't say it. It's when you do everything with that, again, wrongful intent, and then say, oh, I didn't know that was a law. But what the Rehaf court says, and I want to read it to make sure I don't get it right, the maxim does not normally apply when a defendant has a mistaken impression concerning the legal effect of some collateral matter, and that mistake results in a misunderstanding of the full significance of his conduct. And then they go on later, your status as someone who's ineligible refers to a legal matter, but it's a collateral question of law. And a person who does not know that status doesn't have the guilty state of mind. So I know that in the past, you know, the Minnesota courts have said ignorance of the law is no excuse and just sort of thrown it out there. But we have a more full description of how that principle should work. Now, Mr. Mitchell is, you know, he does have that conviction that does qualify as a crime of violence from Minnesota. But his ineligibility to possess a firearm is a collateral consequence. And that's what they say. When it's a mistaken impression concerning the legal effect of a collateral consequence and the mistake results in misunderstanding the full significance, then you don't apply ignorance of the law is no excuse. And so it wouldn't come into play here.
In Greer, the Supreme Court basically said, well, most felons know that they're felons. Mm-hmm. So, and there was no argument that he didn't know he was a felon. So tough. We're not going to reverse it under plain error. Mm-hmm. So you're saying this is different because he knew he was a felon, but he didn't know he was a bad felon, i.e. a crime of violence felon. Sure. Was that sort of what you're saying?
Correct. He doesn't know that he's ineligible because of that. That comes out through the plea hearing where they say, you know, we've talked and now you know that that's a crime of violence.
I mean, but I guess I find this a little confused. I mean, the question is, at the time you would agree you were ineligible to possess that firearm. And then earlier he said, and you agree that your, you know, second degree burglary, you would agree that under Minnesota law, that would qualify as a crime of violence. So he says that, but you want him to say, and you know that because it's a crime of violence, that's what makes you ineligible. You want us to say you've got to ask that question? Is that sort of it?
Yeah, I think there's an important part of the line that you just quoted.
But I mean, isn't that logical, though? I mean, it's kind of like, wouldn't it flow? I mean, why do we have to ask that question? I guess I'm having trouble understanding why we have to ask that third question. Wouldn't logic flow that, well, that's why you're being convicted?
No, Your Honor, because there's an important part in that line, which is after speaking with your attorney, would you agree that under Minnesota law, that would qualify as a crime of violence? So what comes through in the plea hearing is he doesn't know that he's prohibited until after the possession has happened, until after he has spoken to his attorney. The mens rea, that wrongful intent, has to co-occur or concur, I guess, with the prohibited act. That's how mens rea works.
I mean, all right, let's say we make this change in the law that you want. And then, you know, similar facts, it's Colorado, it's blah, blah, blah. And he gets up, he says, I forgot that it was a crime of violence when I possessed the gun in Minnesota. Is that a defense?
I don't know that it would be necessarily an affirmative defense. I think that, let's say that that's what he said. And can I move this to sort of a trial scenario?
Sure. Fine.
He could testify at a trial and say, I forgot. And then it would be up to the jury to decide whether that was credible and whether they really believed he forgot and therefore didn't know, or if he did know.
But all right. But what you're saying is, well, fine. Let's say then the jury rejects that argument and convicts him. You know, they don't find it credible. Can he make a petition for post-conviction relief saying that you know, I forgot, you know, in the interest of justice, there was no evidence that I didn't forget. So can he make a petition for post-conviction relief and say, get me out? Because they haven't proved an element of the crime?
He could make that petition, but I think, and I realize I'm the one who moved it to a trial scenario, not you, but how that would then be reviewed is, I think the court would say, well, we're going to look at whether the evidence was sufficient to convict. So we're going to look at all the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict and believe that, or assume that the jury disbelieved any evidence contrary to the verdict. So they wouldn't even consider that. I mean, maybe to put this in sort of a different context of how this would be proved, the predatory offender registration. You have to register if you're convicted of one of those crimes in Minnesota. You have to register if you're convicted of one of those crimes outside of Minnesota. So if you had to register because of that and move to Minnesota, the state still needs to prove that you knew that you had to register to get a conviction. So if in that scenario you were to say, oh, I forgot I had to register, again, I don't know what a jury would do with it. But if a jury said, well, we're going to convict you because we don't believe you, you can still prove that you knew about this conviction. And if you say, I forgot, it's up to a jury to decide that. And I forgot is also very different, I think, from saying, I never knew. I did not know. If we put Mr. Mitchell up in this scenario and they said, did you know? And he said, I did not know until I spoke with my attorney after I was arrested and charged with this and after the possession happened, that would be a different case because right. The mens rea needs to concur with that prohibited act.
Would it be fair to say, I mean, I take it in this case where he pled, there's no evidence in the record that he didn't know it was a crime of violence. Is that a fair statement? I mean, there's no affidavit saying I didn't know that burglary in Colorado was a crime of violence in Minnesota that would make me ineligible to possess a firearm. There's no evidence of that in the record.
Where it comes through is there's not, you know, evidence that you would present to trial, but where it comes through is that statement of after speaking with your attorney, you would agree.
Right. But I mean, okay. So the attorney reminded them so the attorney told him it's a crime of violence. Burglary is a crime of violence in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Let's assume that's what his attorney said, but that's different from saying, I never knew that. That's just saying my attorney now told me that. That's not like I never knew that. I mean, isn't that the difference?
There is that difference, but this is, and I realize my time is up, but if I could just briefly respond.
Go right ahead, Ms. Gadonovan.
I think the difference is that didn't come up. A, I acknowledge that I'm asking you for a new rule. And B, this was a guilty plea done with all leading questions. And I'm not saying that that makes the plea invalid. I know that it's disfavored, though. But so he's not asked, oh, did you know that? No one asks him that. They say, now that you've talked to your attorney, would you know? So there's really not an opportunity for that evidence to come in based on how this colloquy came through. So,
okay, fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Donovan. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Kathleen Scher, and I am the attorney for the respondent in this case, State of Minnesota. Your Honors, I think that this, we've covered a lot of ground of what I was already going to cover, but this really comes down to that the appellate courts have long held that ignorance of the law is not an excuse. And that's really what it comes down to in this case. There's been a lot of argument in both the briefs and as well as today that the Rehoff case is presidential in this case and that the court should follow the guidance of the court in that case. But I will turn largely to appellant's reply brief in this case and pointing out that the Rehoff and the Greer cases deal with different law. They deal with federal statute, and federal and state statutes are different. I would completely agree here. What the court is dealing with here is with a state statute that is different from the federal statute and different from the requirements there.
Can I ask you, before you get to that, because you kind of touched on it, this ignorance of the law concept. You know, counsel for the appellant argues that it doesn't apply here because we're talking about a collateral consequence. And that's a different standard. How do you respond to that argument?
Judge, I think that the legislature has already written that into the statutes. In under 624.713 subdivision 3, the statute specifically holds that the court, failure of the court to inform a defendant that the person has been convicted of a crime of violence does not allow them to subsequently violate that statute and possess a firearm. So the legislature is already taking care of that problem and said, even if the courts forget, you are still prohibited from possessing a firearm. On that same note, there's been a lot of talk about the fact that this is a crime of violence or that defendant's prior conviction is a crime of violence in Minnesota is what prohibits him from possessing a firearm. That's what prohibits from him from possessing a firearm under this statute. But under subdivision 10, a person who's convicted of a felony, not a crime of violence, a felony is also prohibited from possessing a firearm. And that specifically talks about a crime punishable by imprisonment for a term exceeding 1 year. Now, the Rehoff court, as I indicated, has to do with federal statute. Federal statute is different from state statute. Greer also has to deal with that. And there has been, of course, reaction from this Rehoff decision. And there have been other cases that have addressed whether this should apply to the state courts. But there has not been a case yet that has made this applicable to the state courts, at least that I was able to find. In fact, they specifically indicate that these are different statutes requiring different things, and it's not something that should be read into the state statutes. Now, we talked a little bit about the mens rea of the statute, and I would agree with what I'm interpreting is this court's interpretation that the knowing knowing part of the statute, the mens rea part of that, is that he knowingly possessed a firearm, similar to knowingly possessing controlled substances. He has to know that he's actually possessing that firearm, not his status. And I just touched on that with that the courts are not even required to if the courts forget, it's still prohibited conduct. The Rehoff case and the subsequent Greer and Gary cases do touch on the fact as well that in the federal courts, the defendant needs to prove his actual innocence in order for them to get that Rehoff relief. If the court were to apply that here, the defendant here would not be able to prove his actual innocence. You need to make a demonstrated showing. Now, there's only been one case that I've been able to find that's been able to meet that burden. In showing that under the federal statute, if you have a misdemeanor offense that's punishable by more than 2 years, then that statute would apply, or you wouldn't know that you were a felon, as it's not a felony conviction. That is the only case that I've been able to find where Rehoff would apply, and the court has been willing to overturn someone's conviction just based on those differing terms, that this has always been referred to as a felon in possession. Not a person that's convicted of a misdemeanor that would apply as prohibiting you from the statute. As the courts have held in several different cases and quote over and over again in Greer and Gary, is that if a person's a felon, he knows he's a felon. This is not something that, not the kind of thing that a person simply forgets. Now, I don't think there's any argument here that, and I'm certainly not conceding, I do believe that this is not, that the Rehoff holding should not apply in this case. But even if the court were to find that, the courts have held that Rehoff does not apply retroactively. They've held that it's not stating a new rule of constitutional law. It's addressing the federal statutes that have been enacted for Congress and really clarifying those under the federal rules. And so even if the court were to find that they should read some second element of mens rea into this statute, it wouldn't apply in this case. It would not have retroactive effect. Now, I think the only other thing I would touch on is that there was some discussion as well with regard to the plea itself and whether the defendant actually admitted or whether his attorney had informed him that his underlying offense was a crime of violence. But if you look at the transcript itself, that's much further up in the transcript than where the defendant talks about or admits that he knew he was prohibited from possessing a firearm. And I don't think it's unusual for a plea allocee to go over all the things that your attorney has covered with you. I mean, that's expected that they're going to cover with the elements of the crime, understand whether there's any defenses or facts of the case that his attorney has discussed with him and whether he understands that he is in fact guilty of this offense. That's what happened here. And while I agree that leading questions are not what this court has favored, that's not the issue in this case. I would certainly agree that the plea could have been taken better. But I think, I don't think that there's an attorney out there that would argue that there's ever a perfectly tried case or perfectly performed plea. It's not a movie script. It just doesn't happen that way. And so unless the court has anything else, any other questions for me, I'd be happy to address those, but I don't have any further argument for the court. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Donovan, you'll have the last word, sir.
Wait for the clock here. I want to make a a couple of just very quick points based on some things that counsel for the state just said. First of all, counsel for the state mentioned subdivision 10 in the statute, which is anyone convicted of any felony in any court. First of all, that's not what he pleaded guilty to. Second of all, that's a gross misdemeanor, which is way different than the 5-year sentence that Mr. Mitchell is currently serving. The state mentioned that, you know, it couldn't find a case or it doesn't think that Mr. Mitchell will be able to prove his innocence. He doesn't have to prove his innocence. The state would have to prove that he knew he was not eligible to possess a firearm. Counsel for the state said that rehab is not retroactive. We're not asking for a retroactive effect. It's a case from 2019. We're in 2021. The plea hearing, he does not admit that he knew of that conviction. He said he agrees that he was ineligible. Counsel for the state mentioned that in controlled substance, you just have to knowingly possess. In a controlled substance crime, you still have to know the nature of the item. You have to know what it is for a conviction. That's another offense, sort of like this one, with two mens rea elements. You have to know two things for that conduct to be illegal.
But in the, you know, in the drug near a school case, you know, you don't have to know you were near a school. And it seems to me, or that you're in a school zone. And it seems to me, it would be more difficult to know where the school zone is than whether your crime is a crime of violence. I mean, at least, you know, you're sort of put on notice that, gee, maybe I should check that out if I'm going to possess a gun. Is that a fair statement, Mr. Donovan?
There's a big difference with that case in that what they were really asking for in Benefield was truly a third mens rea element. Because it's already guilty of drug possession, so he has to know he possessed it. He has to know what the item is. They were essentially saying, hey, you should also have to know you're in a school zone. Now, regardless of whether he was in a school zone or not in a school zone, his possession of that controlled substance was illegal. If Mr. Mitchell just possessed a firearm, that is not illegal behavior unless he's prohibited. So that's why we're asking for that second mens rea. That's the difference, is that firearm possession is not per se illegal.
So in effect, after the last question on page 6 of your brief, and at that time you would agree that you were ineligible to possess that firearm, and he says yes. Mm-hmm. In effect, you want us, the prosecutor, to say, why was that the case? That way he could say, oh, because burglary is a crime of violence under Minnesota law, and that's what makes it ineligible. You want him to ask why?
I want him to ask why. In a perfect world, I want them to ask why. In a world like
what
this,
if he
where...
says, can I have a moment to speak to my lawyer? And the lawyer then explains to him why, mm-hmm. off the record. And then we go back on the record and he says, oh, I know now why. Is that enough?
I don't think that would be enough because he's saying, now I know why. If we go back to sort of how the rest of this plea went, though, is if they would have just said, you know, not why are you ineligible? You knew you were ineligible at that time. Yes, that would be enough. You could still, again, leading questions, not preferred. You could still have leading questions in this scenario and just asking the simple question, you knew at that time that you were ineligible. That would be a valid plea.
And if he said, no, I don't know, I didn't know, that would not be a valid plea.
Under the rule that we're proposing, no, that would not be a valid plea.
So it could be, so any of these scenarios could be true that would make it an invalid plea. No, I didn't know at the time. No one explained to me, or three, I forgot. Any of those statements on the record in a colloquy would queer this whole plea. Would that be a fair statement?
That would be a fair statement. But what should happen then in that scenario is the district court, having read, you know, an opinion from this court that adopts my rule, would say, I can't accept this plea because this is not a valid factual basis. So you guys need to go figure it out. And it would sort of stop it at the source.
And then there'd be more consultations with lawyers.
Yes. Yes.
And then would see the light.
Yes. Perhaps.
I can't wait for this rule.
I do just very briefly want to touch on notice. I only have 30 seconds left. That notice provision is sort of a red herring because it does not create an element of the offense or negate an element of this offense. That puts a duty on the district court and it absolves a duty. Or absolves the district court if it fails to fulfill that duty. But there are situations, the Grillo case mentions, where notice is going to be impossible to get from the district court, but you can still learn other ways. So that notice provision is really, it comes up in due process claims because notice is so important in due process. So I have 5 seconds left.
I have one last question. Even if we agreed with you that there should be a mens rea on this, didn't the legislature already decide this issue when they wrote the statute? And particularly in light of the fact that they added the statute that says if the court fails to give you notice or fails to tell you you're ineligible, that doesn't affect, you know, you being charged or the penalty. I mean, hasn't the legislature already spoken on this, and how can the court interject its own opinion regarding how this statute should read?
I will try to keep my answer brief because I know I'm out of time, but to address that, what you're looking for if the legislature is trying to remove a mens rea element is a positive indication. Like I said, Subdivision 3 is just about the district court, not about what the person knew. And so what you would want to say the legislature has decided this is a statement somewhere in an earlier in Subdivision 1 saying a person's lack of knowledge of their ineligibility does not affect a conviction. Because again, there are going to be circumstances where the court can't inform you. If you're from out of state, the district court can't inform you. But if you knew you were ineligible, you could still be guilty. And so that is not, I don't think, a statement from the legislature saying there is no mens rea on that element. So if the court has no other questions, we would just ask that Mr. Mitchell be permitted to withdraw his guilty plea as invalid.
Thank you very much, Mr. Don. Thank you, Ms. Schur. The matter is submitted.